30,000 feet up, breaking all the lights on the doors. And I ain't seen no ceilings. We came in through the top floor. Three R's rip right round your jugular.
You're listening to Feminist Killjoys, PhD, an hour of feminism, pop culture, and politics, as discussed by two professional killjoys.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Melody.
And today, we are talking with Akthis, who is a PhD student at the University of Maryland, and we talk to them about third world feminisms, and it is such an interesting conversation. I'm really excited for everybody to listen to it. But first, before we get to that, Melody, where can our listeners find us on the internet?
In select places, let me tell you where. You can subscribe to us using your favorite podcast application. Extra FKJ points if you leave us a review on iTunes. And just as a reminder, your iTunes app now has a review function, so feel free to use that. On the social media tip, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. On Facebook, we are in three different places now. You can like our page, Feminist Killjoys PhD, just to get episode updates. You can join our closed community page, which is Feminist Killjoys Community WTF Power exclamation point. That's where we have more conversations about content. People post other resources. Sometimes it's an advice column, you know, whatever. Although, you know, I'd redirect them to Rachel's new advice column.
Thank
and then
you.
We also have, you're welcome. We also have a book club where we're discussing emergent strategy, and that is FKJ PhD reading group.
Reading group.
FKJ PhD reading group. Find us all there on Facebook. And then on the Fi, we have Feminist Killjoys PhD mixtape, which you can search for and follow, which gets added to very often. It's curated by Rachel. And then if you have some extra dollars and want to support us feminist media makers, you can do that in a few ways. One, you can go to our website, which is Feminist Killjoys podcast.com. Scroll down, click on the birdie, and you can leave us a one-time donation. Or you can become a Patreon, and patrons get access to our Killjoy newsletter, which is sent out weekly. And then we also create bonus content, which is available to people who donate $5 or more a month. And Rachel wants to give a special shout out to our new Patreons that we got this past week. Take it away, Rachel.
Thank you, Candy and Dominic. Yay!
We're Dominic, I owe you some mail, for real.
Yeah, Dominic is a multi-supporter. He's supported in two different kinds of capacities. So we owe Dominic double thanks. And Candy, thank you so much for also joining our Patreon this week. We hope you all are enjoying the newsletter and all of the other benefits of feeling good about supporting feminist media makers.
That is true. Last but not least, you can email us at fkj.phd@gmail.com. How are you, Rachel?
Thank you for asking. I'm well, but exhausted. I occasionally lead yoga sculpt teacher training programs. So many of the listeners know that I'm a yoga teacher and also a sort of a group fitness instructor at the yoga studio where I teach. And so sometimes I lead the trainings that teach people how to be teachers. And this was the first weekend of the program. And the first weekend involves all night Friday night, all day Saturday, all day Sunday. And it's just it's a lot of energy and a lot of work, but it's a really, really amazing and lovely environment to be in. I think some of our listeners will be excited to know that I am doing my tiny part. So the place that I work is a national corporation, and they're not remotely explicitly feminist or anti-oppressive in any way. They think that they are good in that they want people to feel good because of yoga. They have donation classes and stuff, but they're not like radical or even explicitly progressive in any sense of the imagination. And that is evident when in the book, in the training program, there's all this stuff about like weight loss and like lean bodies. And so I just in the training was like, okay, like get your pens out and start crossing this shit out, because this is not what we are here for. In fact, and like my co-lead and I, who's a really rad feminist, we were like, actually, we've gained weight because muscle is weight gains weight. And we're just like really bulky and amazingly ripped, and it's awesome. And so we got to have a nice little like fuck this fatphobic nonsense. Also, P.S., mm-hmm. you're probably not going to lose weight, and that's totally great. So that's been interesting. And then I also went to a Halloween party last night, which was just – I just had, like, such a high-energy weekend, which is not normal for me. I'm, you know – usually I need like more regroup time, but so I'm good. I'm just tired, but it's good. I was, did you see what I was for Halloween?
I was just going to say like your costume was pretty baller. I just love how you always find ways to like get super, super femme for Halloween. Well, I mean, of course there's the beard too. So I appreciate the gender play there, but I was like, of course that's our outfit. No, it looked rad. Right. It looks super cool.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks.
So sorry, please explain to the viewers who have not, listeners who have not seen it.
So, you know, the joke is like every Halloween costume is like a slutty or sexy version of something. So I was none other
no,
than...
No, I've never noticed that before.
You've never noticed that? You didn't know that was a thing. That's a thing.
No, no. I mean, I hear that feminists talk about that, but I've just never really seen like an inappropriate, sexy Halloween costume at all. So,
right.
Sorry.
So I decided to become sexy Karl Marx, or as a friend suggested, that I was a commodity fetish, which is a theory of Marx's that also sounds like fetishism, like sexy stuff. So, yeah, I wore like a bodysuit that was kind of like bondagey and like a suit coat that kind of looks like what KM looks like in his portrait and a beard, but I was only wearing a bodysuit and the tights, so just it was like pretty scandalous. And then I had a copy of the Communist Manifesto with me, so it was fun. It was really fun. Yeah, I was femmed up, sexy, but had my nice Carl beard and made puns, like sex puns about communist writing. It was great. What about you? How's your weekend been?
Do you know what I would be for Halloween?
Tell me.
If I dressed up? I would be Lacey as she records her podcast very far away from the mic. That's what I would be. I would just go around. I'd wear like a tank top that says No Bro Vibes and then some like yoga pants and have a polar with me and then have a mic 3 feet away from my face with my headphones on. That's what I would be for Halloween.
LOL. If you aren't in on that joke, you should all listen to Lacey Davis's podcast with her husband, Ket, called Adult Crash. And we now sort of have like, apparently, what's that? What's in hip hop? Like a diss track or something? What do you call that thing where you go back and forth? You know, like where you write a song. Diss tracks. Yeah, I was right.
Yeah.
So now we're basically, you and Lacey are like diss tracking each other about podcast vocals. I'm here for it. If Lacey is. Lacey, can you handle it?
Where do we go next? The latest one.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what the response is. So.
And hopefully everybody knows that.
OVO.
You know, this is all in good fun and we love her. We're not actually saying anything mean.
No.
Cool.
Love you, Lacey.
What else did you do this weekend besides daydream about
Come up with my Halloween costume?
Yeah, exactly.
Poof. I mean, that took a while. So I just did some like fun projects around the house, just kind of I'm so boring. I cleaned my house. I hung up a thing so I can dry my clothes.
Great.
More in the winter downstairs in my basement.
Great.
I made some fall. I just freaking love fall.
Me
I just did
too.
Fall shit all weekend.
That's
I just
so great.
Love it.
I love it too. It's the best.
So much more energy. So I made some candied yams using Issa's holiday cookbook.
Love it.
Which I love. And I also shoveled some leaves into an area that could use some more. You know how the new thing is now that you're not supposed to rake your leaves. You're just supposed to like spread them around your yard and use it as I keep thinking of the word manure, but like it's just supposed to keep your grass healthy. It's like good for the earth, like to compost.
Like a fertilizer.
Yeah, fertilizer, that's the word.
I didn't know that because I'm not a homeowner and I've never raked leaves, since I was a kid. But that's interesting to know. That's good to know.
And the only reason I knew that before I was a homeowner is because I would always be the caretaker at, like, apartment buildings especially the last one that I was at. So we actually did do all the raking.
Okay.
And also, I'm so, like, environmentally, these lifestyle things, I hear about all of them. So
right.
Anyways,
cool.
The new thing is to not rake your leaves. The other thing I did this weekend is in the Feminist Killjoy review newsletter, you had written kind of within a paragraph something about like, and you should know your dosha. I don't know my dosha or doshas or what's the correct?
Dosha, because it refers to your entire like composition. So you might be multi-doshic, but it's like your dosha is your composition singularly.
Got it. So I did it and it's the Ayurvedic,
mm-hmm.
Is that a
yep.
Way of living? And it's so amazing. It's like magic and stuff. It's like, I don't even care if it's a bunch of BS. I think it's real. And it's like so cool to find out. So basically, if you haven't done it, this is the newbie version of it. You take this quiz online and then they tell you what your dosha is or are. And so I'm the V and the P, Pritta, and I'm basically energy and intensity.
Yeah.
Or creativity and intensity.
Yeah. That doesn't surprise me that those are what you got.
Yeah. Big surprise.
Yeah.
What was even more interesting is then they tell you, these are the kind of spices you should use. These are the kind of foods that would be good for you. These are the problems that you have with your body. And they were all right. Like yep. they're already things that I'm drawn to.
Yep.
So they were saying like some, I wasn't like spices, but they were basically naming like my favorite scents, like rose and sandalwood and mm-hmm. cedar. My favorite combination of oils is sandalwood and rose. And like, I need warm foods because I love fall, but it's also good for digestion. I have mm-hmm. bad digestion.
Yeah.
They like predicted my who I was yeah. just based on a couple. It's just, I'm sold.
Yeah.
Sell me everything. Yes. yep. Sell me face oil. Sell me recipes. I'm
right.
in.
Right.
Because I feel so visible.
Yeah.
Did you have the same experience when you figured out your dosha?
I really did. I mean, it kind of felt similar okay. to it felt similar to astrology in that I was like, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, this is like helping me better understand myself because it totally gets me. Yeah. And it's not, it's 100% not BS. Like it would, I mean, it is a science. It is a science of, you know, ancient wisdom that we definitely should not dismiss at all. And yeah, it's really powerful stuff. It was one of my favorite parts about, yoga teacher training. And a friend of mine, even before I did yoga teacher training, my friend Binya, who I'm sure I've mentioned on the podcast before, she's one of my most favorite humans. She is an Ayurvedic practitioner and a feminist and a Marxist and is just like such an awesome gal. And so I learned about it a lot from her as well. And yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Like it's really about creating balance in your body. And so if you have like really frenetic and sort of anxious energy, like they're going to recommend that you eat foods that are going to ground you down. So you need, mm-hmm. you know, if you have a lot of that kind of stuff. I was strongly Pitta when I first took it.
That's mine.
Yeah. Yep. Pitta.
That's one of them.
Yeah. So very like intense and fiery. And so, you know, for example, if I eat spicy foods, it can feel really irritating because I'm already like very hot inside as it is.
Yeah.
And that's also another reason why we don't like summer, Mel. Because we already have enough fucking fire.
Yes.
So we like to be cooled down. We feel better when we're balanced out. And no, in some cases, fire is attracted to fire because it's like we want intensity, which is why like I'm attracted to the kind of exercise I'm attracted to, even if I don't always, even if it's not always what's best for me. So you have to like figure that out too. And like I like spicy foods, but I just know they make me feel kind of rough after I eat them. So you have, you know, it's like making, it's not like, it's not only like your likes and dislikes. It's like what makes your body feel aligned and balanced.
Exactly. Yeah. And so my other one is Vata. That's mm-hmm. the creative one. Are you saying the like thing? Cause that's the word that I use, like the things that I like or not don't like.
Yeah. I mean, I was responding to that. Yeah. But
just because like the way that it was just interesting because the things that I like, quote unquote, like are some of the things that are good for me, you
yeah.
know? So whereas like spicy foods, right? I got that same thing. It's like, man, I do like spicy foods, but it does irritate my stomach.
Right.
And it's just going to help me because I know I have bad digestion.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just really reassuring, like to be like, you should just eat warm, easy to digest foods. It's cool.
Right.
I can do that.
Right.
You know how sometimes you feel like, we talk about this a lot in the summer. It's like, how come you don't like summer? And it just makes me feel better. It's like, oh, there's actually like a real scientific reason for yeah. why I don't like summer. It's not just because, I don't know, I'm a Debbie Downer.
Right. Totally.
Or a Drew Downer or whatever gender neutral word you want to use.
Right. Right.
I don't know. It was just very eye opening. So thank you for putting that in the newsletter. And I'm in. I'm all in.
Totally.
I'm going to get real into it.
And yeah. Great. Yeah. Love it. I would love to get to our interview with Akthis.
I'm ready.
It was so great. So Akthis is a PhD student, like I said, at the University of Maryland, studying postcolonial literature and queer of color critique. Their work revolves around postcolonial representations of surveillance and security, and they examine how transnational surveillance policies, rather polices, trans and queer bodies in the global south. Akthis is a Pakistani Muslim feminist who believes in centering trans and gender nonconforming folks of color in social justice movements. And you get to hear about all that and more. They are super smart and just had such, I think, important and nuanced perspectives and perspectives that we don't get to hear nearly as much as we should, mm-hmm. particularly when we're talking about people who are perceived as third world or particularly women and gender nonconforming folks in the global mm-hmm. South. So it was a great interview, and I'm really excited for our listeners to hear. Will you take us there?
Well, welcome, Ekthus, for joining us. We really appreciate you coming in and talking to us about third world feminism. But first off, before we get into the nitty gritty, if you could just introduce yourself and tell us what you do.
All right, awesome. So I am a PhD student at the University of Maryland. I am in the English department, but a lot of my work is actually based in women's studies. I'm also getting a certificate in women's studies. So my research revolves around post-colonial representations of surveillance and militarism and security culture, and how this globalized surveillance culture is policing trans and queer bodies in the global South. And my framework does stem a lot from post-colonial feminism, even though I'm trying to like decenter cis feminism and center like trans feminism more these days. I also like to write for non-academic folks because I really think that it's important for us to like translate heavy like dense theory into like more accessible language. So I've written some pieces for Bitch Media, and most of my pieces have revolved around critiques of like imperialist cis feminism.
That's awesome. That's one reason we started the podcast, is to try to sort of translate academic stuff to wider audiences. So we totally love meeting other academics who do that. And also, your research sounds amazing. And speaking of your research, we want to just start really broadly and just talk about what third world feminism is in terms of sort of the history of it as a movement. And also, if you want to get into sort of scholarship around it, we'd just love to hear you just sort of talk about that.
Yeah, sure. So third world feminism, the way I think of it is that it's basically a critique of like white Western Euro-American feminism. It like critiques the way third world women of color have been framed by white feminism in the service of imperialism and empire, so how they've been portrayed as a homogenous group and as like passive victims of local cultural oppression. It also critiques the universalism of like white Western feminism, so the idea that like a certain kind of feminism is basically for everyone around the globe. One other main theme that has been prevalent in third world feminist discussions has been the idea of the white feminist savior complex. So here I'm thinking of Laila Abu-Lagoud's work. She has written about the discourse of like saving Muslim women and how this discourse is used not actually to liberate Muslim women, but actually to create racist stereotypes of Muslim cultures as barbaric and violent. And also like many third world feminisms, like state and restate, how it is important to examine oppression not only as a result of local patriarchy, but also as a result of multiple intersecting factors like imperialism, colonialism, neoliberalism, capitalism. Also, I like, while this would be sort of like a simplistic definition of third world feminism, I do also think that the term third world, as it is used these days, is pretty tricky, because third world, in the post-Cold War era, it was used to imply like transnational solidarity between different colonized or post-colonial nations. Nowadays, I feel like it's mostly used as a synonym for the global South. It's also, I think, sometimes used just to suggest poor countries. And even though third world, like, I do think that like it refers to countries that were colonized or are currently being colonized by institutions like the IMF or the World Bank, the term still doesn't account for a lot. It like flattens a lot of internal differences. So I'm thinking about like economically disadvantaged regions, it does not take into account the power of the elites or the first world within the third world. It also doesn't account for a lot of like internal colonization. So, for example, the occupation of Kashmir by the Indian military. And I think that this like translates into feminism also, right? Like third world feminism, sometimes like that term can erase differences between regions, between countries, between classes, between ethnicities and castes. So I think sometimes it can be productive to use third world feminism, so like in the plural instead of the singular. Also thinking about like obviously how like African feminisms and South Asian feminisms and Latin American feminisms have such a vastly different history. and look very different. And my work focuses a lot on South Asian feminism, so I think that I should just speak mostly about that.
Thank you for expanding so much on that. That's so interesting to hear you frame it in those ways. As I'm very familiar with, I sort of got into Marxism through Third World Marxism, and so it's very mm-hmm. much about that sort of solidarity of colonized nations, but I really appreciate the way you're nuancing that. And you know, and I've heard, you know, the push to create the plural, the third world feminisms. Yeah. And I think you explained that so clearly of why that is really important. And so thank you. That's super interesting.
I just had a follow-up question. I was actually just having a conversation with my friends who are in town about third world feminisms. And the question came up of not referring to it as post-colonial feminism. And so is the use of the term third world like a reclaiming or a use you're using it to, you were saying recenter what it actually means, but within the U.S. context, and like if you're speaking with white feminism or white feminists, like is it a... Yeah, some of it a reclaiming of the term. And also, my question is, why not post-colonial feminism? Like, where's the difference there for you?
All right. Yeah, I think that's a great question, especially because I've been thinking about the genealogy of post-colonial feminism also, especially in terms of scholarship. So I think that it's really important for post-colonial scholars to tie the trajectory of post-colonial feminism and post-colonial feminist theory to intersectionality, because the first time sort of I encountered the term third world woman being used in scholarship was actually in Black feminist thought and in women of color feminisms in the U.S. So I think that it's important to connect post-colonial feminism with the genealogy of like Kimberly Crenshaw's work. I'm also thinking of like the Combahee River Collective's critique of white feminism and their solidarity with whom they call third world women. Also thinking of Gloria Anzaldúa and Sherry Moraga's This Bridge Called My Back, in which many authors write from the positionality of the third world woman. And even though they use third world in a different way, so sometimes they use third world to like refer to women of color in the U.S. or immigrant women of color in the U.S., I still think that a lot of the frameworks that were developed in intersectionality and in like women of color feminisms have been used by post-colonial scholars. I do use the term post-colonial feminism because I think that third world feminism has definitely been used by some people to like reclaim that space also. But just because I am working within South Asia, which has so many sort of like developments of elite centers within the third world, I think it's more productive to use post-colonial because post-colonial also encompasses ideas of nationalism and really harmful, violent nationalism. And when I think of post-colonial feminism, I'm also thinking of like seminal sort of scholars like Chandra Mohanty's essay, Under Western Eyes, which critiques like the universal category of woman, also critiques the homogenization of the oppressed like third world woman. So even though I guess the term third world pops up, for me, it's about connecting the genealogy of certain post-colonial feminisms to post-colonial thought. So post-colonial thought as developed by like Gayatri Spivak and Homi Bhabha and Edward Said, and how certain feminists have responded to that particular discourse by inserting a feminist lens.
Mm-hmm. Super interesting. Yeah, good clarifying question, Mel. So Melody and I both came out of a media studies program. So I'm interested if you could speak to how the media plays a role in perpetuating these myths that you discussed about women in the third world, the sort of monolithic representations and anything else that you think the media does in terms of both journalism, news, and also any, you know, fictitious representations.
So I think in terms of media, especially in the U.S., so there are stereotypes that are created by the right or more like conservative media, but also by the left or more liberal media. And sometimes they join hands to create stereotypes about certain places in the global South. And I think a lot about like Muslim majority countries and how certain stereotypes about Muslim men and women circulate. So like Muslim men are like usually portrayed as like violent, savage, and like really complicit in sexual violence more than like white men. And Muslim women are portrayed as either like completely desexualized or weak or passive, like unable to speak for themselves. And I see these like the stereotypes used both in like more conservative media venues, but also in like more sort of liberal media. And I think that like stereotypes about the passive Muslim woman came up with Laura Bush's idea of like liberating the oppressed, abused Afghan woman from the burqa, which she used to justify the war on terror in Afghanistan, especially. And so when I first came to this country, I came for college, and the first year reading that was assigned was Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wooden's Half the Sky, which was really prevalent in many different colleges and has also been made into a documentary. And this film and book creates like really ahistorical, simplistic narratives of women in the global south, and focuses only on like women's oppression and not on their resistance, and also sort of has this implicit framework that like white feminists or even white men should like save black and brown women from their own cultures. So I think that like Gayatri Spivak's famous statement that like white men are being positioned to save brown women from brown men can also be applied to white feminism, that like white women are sometimes positioned to save brown women from brown men. And I think in terms of critiquing media, I also think of the scholar Deepa Kumar, whose work has influenced me a lot. And she uses the term colonial feminism, especially to talk about how feminism has not only been co-opted to serve empire, but how feminism has actually actively been complicit in imperialism.
I think that you just mentioned came out with a Media Education Foundation about media coverage of countries and how it's led to this like fearist. So do a whole episode on how awful Nick is. So perpetuating all talking. Yeah. I was like, I know.
And I think the same work of like colonial feminism, which has been critiqued a lot, but it's also been sort of productively used to critique colonial queer movements, which I think about a lot. So I'm thinking of Jasbir Puar's framework of homonationalism, so how a certain discourse has been created to position the US as like exceptionally liberal in terms of queer rights, and like the rest of the global south as really homophobic, which actually is a narrative that's created to sort of bolster US empire. And this also like relates to certain colonial queer movements and how they also use the idea of like the white queer needing to save like brown or black queers from their own like homophobic communities of color. And also I've been thinking about like arguments for trans inclusion in the military these days after like Trump's tweet, which actually like fall into this imperialist trap as well, because those arguments frame the US military as this like liberal institution that is like queer and trans friendly because it has like included queer and trans folks, while ignoring all the damage that US militarism does to queer and trans people of color in the global south. And I think like trans activists and scholars like Dean Spade have spoken at length about the co-optation of trans rights to serve imperialism. Yeah, so I think that these are like really concerning times, because sometimes I see that like white supremacy and white liberalism are best friends these days, because global feminist and queer and trans movements are used for like really racist and colonial purposes.
Absolutely. I mean, all of the examples you just gave, also recently with the Dreamers and the Dream Act, the way that people, liberals talked about these good brown people who start, you know, who are serving in our military, like they, some of them serve our country, and it's like, well, that's not why we should treat them like human beings. Sharing the rage of the way that that's used. And even with the football protest, the Take a Knee, to hear liberals defend the misguided and completely out of left field, like when the right used that as a way to say that, oh, they're protesting the military and the flag, which was wrong, but then to have liberals respond and say, no, you know, it's not, we respect our servicemen, it's about race. And it's like, okay, well, do we need to, yeah, let's talk about defending the protest on the grounds of racial injustice, but we don't need to say that we're pro-military in order to defend this act. So it's just all over, I would say, hopefully not most leftists, but certainly like liberal responses to things. So
yeah, for sure. I've also been thinking of like in terms of social media, like the image of the Muslim woman who is wearing the American flag as her hijab, which has circulated so much in very progressive spaces. Yeah, but like, even though she, like, I guess, like, Muslim women are, like, finally being included in, like, feminist movements, I think, like, she's being included because she is not challenging American nationalism, and she's actually wearing the flag.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so like using American like nationalism to include marginalized folks is also, I think, like a very like settler colonial and anti-black move.
Absolutely.
Because it like completely glosses over the history of this country. Yeah.
Totally. Totally. Yeah, that poster was pretty cringy. And no, I mean, I'm sure we have listeners that held it or didn't. So I'm not trying to shame anyone necessarily, but just to be thoughtful about what it means that became the sort of one of the biggest images from the Women's March and beyond. So absolutely.
If I'm not mistaken, Shepard Fairey was the same person who did Barack Obama.
I think that's right.
So that means that's a white man who did.
Yeah. Right, so. Right. Yeah, he's done, I think he's also well known for another woman in a hijab that I've seen sort of like graffitied different places. So it's just interesting the way, a white man is using these people of color. Yeah. So you've spoken to this sort of throughout our conversation, but if you just want to sort of make even clearer how Western feminism is failing at being in solidarity with third world feminisms, and also if at all you could talk about steps that could be taken to center decolonization and anti-imperialism in Western feminist movements.
Yeah, okay. So I think in terms of failing, there are so many stereotypes that are still circulated within feminist circles, and I always like to sort of go back to Chimamanda Adichie's TED talk about The Danger of a Single Story, in which she talks about how the problem with stereotypes is not that they are untrue, but that they are incomplete. So cultural stereotypes are basically not false, but they are actively reducing a story to focus only on the passivity of certain subjects. And they are showing only how certain people are oppressed by local cultures and never by US imperialism or global capitalism. Also, I think that many conversations around the oppression that like women face. So, for example, I'm from Pakistan, and there are many productive conversations about the sort of heteropatriarchy of post-colonial dictatorships. But I think that these conversations only talk about how these post-colonial dictatorships are repressive, which they definitely are. I would be the last person to deny that. But these conversations never present the full picture of how many dictatorships, especially in militarized countries like Pakistan, have had U.S. economic support. So the U.S. has supported all of the sort of military dictatorships in Pakistan, but they have actually like taken away support for democratically elected governments. So I think that these sort of conversations need to be more historical. And we also need to sort of interrogate how certain conversations are being used to serve a particular purpose. And I think that this is not only a fault of like white Western feminists. I think that people in like what we would say the third world are also extremely complicit in this. And I think that like the rise of NGO feminism in the past couple of decades is really concerning to me, because NGO feminism basically uses neoliberal white Western frameworks to tackle a lot of local issues. And many like NGO-based feminists in South Asia, like especially in Pakistan and India, are very urban-based. And many like urban feminists also have this savior complex in regards to women in villages or like women who are less formally educated. So I think of like a lot of feminist movements that exist in the global South that are supported by the US, which like mimic the white savior complex, which is upheld by white Western women. So even though it is actually brown women who are doing the work, they are still like continuing the same problems. And it's important for like everyone to interrogate that also. Yeah. And I think in terms of like us consuming media, it's important to ask ourselves what our motivations for learning or knowing certain like people in the global South are. So I think a lot about the fascination with like how people want to consume like the lives of like women in Iran, or how people want to like understand how gay folks live in Nigeria. And I think that there is this like obsession that I see, especially in like white queer spaces in the US, of like wanting to know the truth about queer and trans lives in the global South. And there's this fetish to consume stories of like faraway queer subjects. So I think it's really important to be metacritical of our own desires to know certain othered like sexual minorities. So I've also been like thinking of this like fad with certain documentaries about Hijra people in the global South. So the Hijra community is like a gender non-conforming community in South Asia. Many people call them trans people, but like that's like they have like rejected that framework. So I'm trying not to do that. And recently I watched a documentary called Guru, and it's made by white folks who went to South India, and like basically it's like an anthropological sort of documentary about the Hijra community in South India. And the film is just like so voyeuristic and focused simply on the viewers like getting to know the intimate lives of these people, and in a way that like gives the audience or the viewer the privileged like voyeuristic gaze. So I think we need to ask ourselves like where our desire to know these folks is stemming from, and also to constantly critique how seemingly feminist or queer media is used for like imperialist purposes. So I constantly hear from like queer Muslim friends that it's hard for them to talk about their narratives because they know that their stories will get co-opted to create like racist stereotypes of their own communities. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to be critical of how certain stories are being framed, even if they're true. Like, I think the framing does a lot of like racist work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so in terms of solidarity, I think that it's important to move away from ideas of inclusion, because inclusion just like sounds so condescending and patronizing to me.
Yeah.
So instead of including marginalized voices, I think feminist and queer movements should center and celebrate the voices of the most marginalized. So sometimes I think of how like very privileged brown feminist folks become spokespersons for the whole culture. So like many times I see like middle class, bougie South Asian women being called to talk about like all of South Asia, or like certain bougie Pakistani women being called to like speak for Muslim feminism when they don't challenge anti-blackness or US imperialism at all, and they hold a lot of privilege within their own communities. It's important to like interrogate differences within differences and to understand them through a historical lens. So thinking about like settler colonialism and how that travels globally, thinking about anti-blackness and how that has become, or like has always been, a global phenomenon,
right?
And how these trees have created certain differences.
Yeah, so many good and important points. I think so much of what you're saying reflects on the importance of letting uniquely marginalized people and communities, not only marginalized from sort of dominant white US culture, but even within the third world or post-colonial world, however you're framing it, to tell their own stories when and if they want to at all on their terms.
Yeah.
And to determine what is the solution to any problems that may or may not exist. And so much of the NGO feminisms that you're describing and the media representation is the exact opposite of that. It's white people deciding the solutions to things and white folks deciding when and how to represent those people. And we actually have a friend who was on the podcast who wrote her dissertation on this sort of philanthrocapitalist NGO feminist model, doing the sort of micro business, micro loan projects in the global South, and just how awful it could be in so many ways that don't seem awful to people who, you know, genuinely, so, you know, there are so many white feminists that genuinely want to do good and try to make things better.
Yeah.
And it's just, I think, something that I value about academia is that it does push you to just ask those questions one step further. And of course, in activist movements too, but depending on what people have access to or not, you know, they're not going to be challenged to ask that question one step deeper. And so I think everything you're saying is so, so important. I'm grateful that you sort of bullet pointed all that out. Did you want to say, I didn't mean to, were you about to say something else? That was wonderful. I'm so grateful for your time.
Yeah, it was great. I learned a lot today. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Is there anything else you do want to share with us that we didn't get to that you wanted to share with our audience?
I guess I could say one thing. Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's also important to critique how we box certain movements that happen in the global South in terms of like regional definitions. So like, why does a movement that happened, for example, in the Middle East or in a certain like West African country get termed as like third world feminism, when different feminist movements in the US do not get boxed in terms of regions? So I think that like you said at the start, that like, while it's really important to note that certain movements in the global South have actively claimed the label of third world to critique like Eurocentric approaches, many feminist movements are not doing that, and they are just being sort of boxed into the like the category of third world feminism by white folks who are viewing their movements as third world simply because they are in a certain like vantage point. Yeah. So just thinking about how certain movements get boxed into like regions or races instead of their like ideas.
Yeah, there's, I mean, in general, yeah. I think, I mean, well, you just said that, you also just said that, that in, you know, there's, when people say the word feminism, I mean, just the ways that those vary and that it's not about, it becomes less about thought and actual ideas, which I understand that people want to find sort of unity and cohesion under this like broad label, but also that's kind of dangerous when one version of feminism mm-hmm. is trying to, for example, grow the prison system to jail rapists, and another group of feminists are trying to do literally the yeah. exact opposite. And so it's so important to talk about those nuances, both in yep. the West and outside of it. So yeah, really, really important point. Was there anything else you wanted to add before we start?
No, that's all.
Okay. Oh, that was so, so great. I'm so glad that Shireen suggested that we talk to you, because it was so great to have you on. We were just so glad to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely.
This was great.
Absolutely. And we're back.
And we're back. Party on, Wayne.
Party on, Garth.
Did we ever discuss who would be whom?
I think we must have. And I think your theory is that I'm Wayne. Is that right?
Yeah.
It's hard. It's a tough one.
I feel like you're more Wayne. We could like switch it up. Also, isn't it really cool that we just finished that interview and then I asked you about two white straight dudes in America?
Yeah, but in a film directed by at least a woman, and a Filipino woman is also in it. But yeah, it's still.
That's a stretch.
It's a stretch. Back to the incredibly important queer of color analysis that we got from Akthis. Wasn't that so good and smart and important?
Yes. Can I confess something to you, though?
Yeah.
You know, I have a hard time with this kind of stuff. My brain hurts a little bit. It was hard because I kept asking those, like I asked that follow-up question about the difference between third world, or why they chose to use the term mm-hmm. third world feminism. Mm-hmm. And even after that explanation, I was still like, I get it. Like, you totally explained it, but my brain like cannot comprehend the intelligence that you just, like mm-hmm. I need to like re-listen to it a couple times, mm-hmm. which is how, like, that's why theory is so hard for me. Like you can hear it once and you're like, I'm good. I mean, I talk about this a lot. I really struggle with theory.
Yeah, no, I think it's great that you're noting that. And I think it's great that this is a podcast that people can like replay and pause and like literally take notes.
Yeah.
And I would just say that, and I hope I've like expressed this before, like I don't think that I'm like some super smart genius who gets all theory. It's theory that there's like a very particular handful of types of theory. And it's, you know, a lot of queer theory, which is usually often very high theory, but for whatever reason, there's this thing that clicks really, really quickly with me. But that is not the case for all theory at all. So, or all writers, depend, you know, in terms of how they're expressing it. So this is something that I have spent a lot of time studying, because some of my, you know, the theorists that were clicking with me do write about this. Jasper Puar, who I'm pretty sure Akthis mentioned, like I first read Puar in my master's program and then reread that same essay and then eventually Puar's first book many times, to the point that it was like, it just became, you know, it's like theory is like learning a language. So like that framework really helped me, because it was like starting at Puar is like starting at like level quadrillion. And so like the fact that I started there and was able to like keep working with it. Anyway, that's just to say, like, some things click with people, some things don't. That's why it's great that people can re-listen to this. And that's cool to share, like, to remind people that we're all learning together and that learning is really exciting but hard sometimes.
I wasn't trying to make you out to be a genius, although you are extremely smart and an amazing writer.
Thank you. Yeah.
Anyways, I made that all about me. You're welcome. So I just don't know what else to say except, like, I'm still processing what they shared with us, and I will be needing to listen to it a few times. I am going to take the backseat on this one.
Well, speaking of you again, what have you been reading, watching, and listening to? Not high theory, apparently. Man.
So the New York Times is on a roll with some really interesting articles. And there's one that actually a friend of mine suggested. It's called The Revolution, When the Revolution Came for Amy Cuddy. And it's about toxic academia and just kind of the stuff that we were talking about last week with that graduate student who got into trouble for using a POC-centered pedagogy tactic in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And so I'm getting through it, and I'll make sure that we – actually, I might actually write up a little bit of something for this for the newsletter, because I think it's really in line with what we are – what we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But another one that I wanted to talk about is this article that I was just reading this morning. Check out this self-care I did, Rachel. I'll make this real fast. I took a bath this morning with a cup of coffee at the fucking New York Times.
Oh, my God. That sounds really beautiful and like a little bougie, but in all ways that I'm totally here for.
Only because it's just self-care, because my therapist.
Totally.
You know what I mean?
Totally. Like, I think that's great. I'm happy that you did that for yourself. Totally.
So my therapist would be, if she was here, she'd be like, good job, Melody.
Yeah.
And I try not to do things just for my therapist, but you know how they're in your head.
Oh,
in
totally. A good way, like, because you know you have to report back. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was like, you know what I'm going to fucking do? I'm going to grab this paper and I'm going to drink my coffee in a warm bath. Anyways.
That's lovely.
So I read this really sad article, of course, called The Lost Children of Tuam, and it's spelled T-U-A-M, but it's a Irish town. And it's spelled, pronounced Tuam. But it's about, it was just this really cool history piece about, so it, the feminist angle is that many, many decades ago, women who gave birth to children out of wedlock were sent away. Remember, you know, because that's what, how we treat women.
Right.
And this girl, at this time, it was a girl, and she had to go to, she went to school with these, like, what they called home children. And she was really, she just remembered them and was really struck by them and just wanted to know answers. And so she went back and tried to find out what actually happened with these children. And it's obviously a very, it ends up being a very sad story because they're just not, they weren't taken care of. And this was right after the Irish famine when a lot of people died. The point of me reading it, or is like, I really need to read this because I like just don't know much about Ireland, and I have a student who's from Ireland, and I was just kind of pushing myself to read something different than what I usually pick out.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I realized this week when I was trying to pick out something to read when I was going to be on the city bus is that I have nothing fun. I have theory. I have sad books. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I have things that like make my brain hurt. Like I'm trying to learn. A gentrification book, like I don't have a romance novel,
right.
Basically,
right.
You know, and it's so hard because I want to have like fun stuff.
Yeah.
And I try, but then like it has to be like it can't be Sleeping Beauty.
Right. Right.
Because like I'm just going to sit there and be like, this is fucked up.
Right.
You know? So I need something. I should just go get some more young adult novels is really what I need to do.
Listeners, let us know if you have any tips for that. Yeah, I mean,
I'm just in one of those spaces.
Totally.
I cycle through and I'm like, shit, I don't have one of those.
Yeah, I mean, that's when I turn to like the witch books and like reading my tarot book and the moon book. But that's not the same because you don't get like wrapped into a story.
No, and the other that was a thing too because I'm learning about the moon stuff,
right.
so it felt
schooly.
Yeah, yeah, like educational. It's like I just need a getaway. It's like I pick up the newspaper. I didn't have anything in my grasp. I was like, oh my God. This is all
devastating, and rough and or difficult.
You know how it
totally.
Is. Yeah.
I hear you. I haven't had a book like that in a really, really long time either. Yeah, I do. I do.
Yeah. Please suggest things, listeners, especially if you read young adult novels. That would be amazing. Okay, last but not least, what I'm listening to is Michael Kiwanuka, who is an amazing soul artist out of England. And he's been around for a while, but my student just recommended him to me. And he just has amazing music. In his most recent album that he released, some people might have heard it on the radio or on Spotify. It's called Black Man in a White World, and it's about just that, and it's just a really awesome song, and I'm totally hooked on him. It's really pretty music, reminds me of 1960s music. He's got great messages in his music. I love him.
Cool. I'm going to check him out. Yeah, I haven't heard him,
suggest him.
Cool.
Yeah, you should. Let me know what you think of him because he's awesome.
I will.
Quiet music for sure.
Cool, cool. Great.
How about you?
I'm reading a book by Grace Lee Boggs called The Next American Revolution. It was the last book she wrote before she died, and I'm really enjoying it. She was a big inspiration. She was sort of a mentor to Adrienne Marie Brown, who wrote Emergent Strategy. So I've really liked Grace Lee Boggs for a while, but the Emergent Strategy reminded me that I should probably read more of her. And it's super accessible writing. She's an activist. You know, she's also a PhD and very smart and well-read. but she's committed to talking about things pretty accessibly in terms of how to build a better world. And it's really it's an inspiring and lovely read. Watching, not a ton. It's been another busy week, but last night, in between the teacher training and going to the Halloween party, we were in one of those situations where it was like cheaper to buy cable and internet than it was to just buy internet. So we ended up finding a way to make it to not have the cable and get cheaper internet. But anyway, the point is, for the next 2 weeks, we have cable. And the only time I give a shit about cable is during holidays, because the Food Network plays holiday themed programming. And I don't know if my listeners know this actually about me, but I'm like obsessed with themes and holidays. Like, I just love a good on theme, whether it's food or decorations.
Have we not discussed that enough?
I don't really think we have, actually. I don't think it's come up much.
It's such a core part of you.
It really is. So clearly I wanted to watch like the cooking specials, like the, you know, the baking challenges where they had to make like, you know, scary donuts and whatever. So I was really excited to have that out in the background. And then listening to a DJ producer named Toki Monsta. She is a really fucking incredible producer of electronic music. And she just put out a new album. And a friend of mine, shout out to friend of the show, Breck, sent me this article about her that I didn't realize. She was super, super, super sick with like a really rare disease that like nearly killed her. And she's very young. It was just a really inspiring read. It was sort of she got like broken up with like a week after she was like out of the hospital, and like just like really tough situation. And then she just created this like beautiful album out of it. She's actually one of the first people that got me hooked on electronic music. I really wasn't into it at all, but she's like fierce as fuck. I actually saw her live. She makes really good music. So I highly recommend her most recent album.
What kind of electronic is it?
I don't know enough about electronic music to like say what kind it is. I mean,
is it sleepy? Is it dancey? Is it techie? Is it?
She collaborates with some pop singers sometimes. So there is like melody to it. It's not like super like club house. You're not going to hear it. Like, I'm sure people don't want to like, well, I'm sure some people like do Molly to it, but like, it's not like where you're like, oh, people probably are on drugs listening to
it. Did you say do Molly to it?
Yeah. I mean, that's like, that scene is like people going to clubs and doing drugs. Is that not like the grammar? Is that incorrect grammar?
No, it's amazing. It's just like you just like mentioned it and then just like kept going. And I was like, wait a minute. We don't talk about Molly on the show where you can just be like, you know, you don't do Molly to it. But anyways,
it's not, I don't do Molly to anything. I don't even know if you do Molly. Do you drop Molly? I honestly don't know. I don't know. I don't
outside know of our wheelhouse.
Anyway, it's not like super, yeah, it doesn't sound druggy to me. I don't know. Is that a weird thing to say? It's accessible.
No,
like,
not
it's
at
accessible
all.
Electronic.
Would you smoke weed to it?
I don't know. I don't smoke weed either. I don't know. It doesn't sound like, I don't know.
You listen to it and decide.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Cool. All right. Well, WTF.
Power. Goodbye.
Happy Halloween.
Aww.